My name is Mike Thornton. This is Full Logic Reverse. We hope you'll stay tuned. We're going to be talking about food and the politics of food today with our guest on the phone from the Bay Area, Peter Rossett, who's the executive director of Food First. Peter, thank you for being with us.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here.
And in the studio, we have with us Rachel Bronson, who is the director of the Nevada County Food Bank, or the Food Bank of Nevada County, as we should properly identify it. Rachel, thank you for being with us as well.
Oh, you're welcome.
Well, we appreciate that you were both able to be here on Full Logic Reverse. Peter, can we talk a little bit first about Food First, and then we can talk about the whole issue of the politics of food? And I know that there was a report that was done specifically regarding Indonesia. Perhaps we can talk a little bit about that, but the topic of food and the politics thereof in general, and then we can talk with Rachel about what are the ramifications of that domestically and more particularly locally. But first, let the listeners know about Food First, if you will.
Great. Well, Food First is really all about the politics of food. Our full name is the Institute for Food and Development Policy. We're a nonprofit education for action and research center based in the Bay Area. We were founded by a woman that I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with, Frances Moore LePay, who wrote the book Diet for a Small Planet. She wrote that 25 years ago, actually almost 30 years ago now. And that was the book that first made the connection clear to many of us that food is something that's at once personal and political. It's personal because it affects our own happiness, our own health, our own bodies, but it's political because the food choices we make, the food system that we shape, has enormous implications for other people around the world, whether they eat or whether they don't, and for the environment as well. So we do a lot of research and public education. We do reports, books, videos, speaking engagements, trying to educate us all about the true causes of hunger in the world, trying to explode some of the popular myths that vested interests and like food corporations would have us believe, and trying to set us on the path towards real food democracy or food for all.
We're also joined by Rachel Bronson of the Food Bank of Nevada County, and Rachel is the director of the food bank. Rachel, talk a little bit about the food bank, if you will.
Sure. The food bank was developed or set up in 1986, and since then we've been distributing food throughout the county on a monthly basis to all those in need, mostly low-income families. And we do that through distribution sites out in the county. We go out to each site, to five different sites throughout the month, and then we have volunteers that come in the other days of the weeks preparing the food that we put together, the non-perishables, to distribute when we go out to the county.
One of the things that I'd like to ask you, Rachel, first, before we go back to Peter Rossett of Food First, are you seeing an increase in the requests for food here locally?
Looking at the numbers, I've only been here a year, but looking at the numbers from last year and previous years, they're up a little bit, but not a whole lot. I'm kind of surprised that we haven't gotten a big increase, especially with the new laws, the welfare laws, but it looks like it's pretty consistent with a gradual upswing.
Okay. One of the things, as I understand it, I think some of the real effects of welfare reform are actually going to beginning to hit in October, as I understand it. And certainly, we don't know what that's going to bode for demand on food here locally.
That's right.
Let's go back to Peter Rossett of Food First. Peter, you talked about the politics of food. Can you talk a little bit more about that, about some of the specifics of what you mean by that?
Well, you know, when we talk about hunger, and hunger is a very serious problem, more than 800 million people in the world don't have enough to eat, and some 30 million of them live right here in the wealthiest nation on earth, often our first response is, well, it must be because there are too many people or not enough food. But in fact, there's more than enough food available in the world, probably to feed each man, woman, and child more than twice as much as we need to live a healthy life. Food production has, despite what Malthus said a long time ago, for the last 35 years has been growing 15 to 16% faster than the human population. Today, there's more food available for every person on this planet than ever before in human history, yet we face worsening hunger. So that tells us that hunger is not an agricultural production problem, it's not a biological problem, it's not a climate problem, it's not a population problem. Hunger is a political problem. People are are not getting access for a variety of reasons to the abundant food that's available. And that immediately puts it into the kind of problem that we have to approach through the political system as opposed to new kinds or methods for production.
We're talking with Peter Rossett, who is the executive director of Food First, joining us from the Bay Area, and Rachel Bronson, who is the director of the Food Bank of Nevada County here locally. Rachel, let me ask you, when you're listening to Peter Rossett of Food First talking about the politics of food and the issue that it's not that there's a lack of food, but that there's a lack of access to food, what are your thoughts on that from being the director of a local food bank here in California?
Well, I'm sure he's right in that. Yeah, I'm definitely sure he's right. We actually are quite fortunate here in our area that we do have some very good help. We have different distribution companies and local grocery stores and establishments that do turn over the food that they don't use to us so that it's not going to waste. And that makes a big difference to us. If we didn't have those kinds of people here, it would be a terrible shame that this food wasn't used. But I'm sure there are many ways that Peter can probably tell us that can happen, that we could use food all over the country that isn't being used.
The question that comes to my mind in all of this is, you know, should people, simply because they're poor, be put in a position where they have to, you know, rely on, you know, basically the charity of grocery stores who are more or less saying, you know, this is going to be our garbage and you know, we'll give it to you rather than throw it in a dumpster somewhere. I mean,
that's not the solution. No, I agree with that. And we have a lot of people, I'm sure, that could use our services that don't, because of the pride factor. They do not feel comfortable being grouped into a group of people that feel like they have to ask for food, and that is a sorry situation in our country.
Peter, one of the things when you were quoting some of the numbers of the just millions and millions of people around the world who are hungry, and you talked about 30 million, I believe, here in the U.S.?
That's right, according to the best estimates from the USDA and Second Harvest and others.
As best as I understand it, if not the majority of those people, certainly a significant percentage of them are children. Is that correct?
That's right. Children and senior citizens are amongst the highest categories. And we've had an evolution of people nationwide who have to rely on soup kitchens and food pantries from the old sort of stereotype of the single unemployed male to families. Increasingly, we find families with children who are, and indeed families with members who have a job, who are on food lines, because minimum wage and the amount of hours available to people have not kept up with the cost of living. We see more and more minimum wage earning families having to choose between shelter and food, giving rise to the two twin phenomena of late 1990s America, the homeless and the food bank.
Let me ask you, because since we're kind of focused on domestic issues here for the moment, I mean, and I certainly want to move to the whole issue of the global perspective, because the United States is, as best as I understand it, the leading producer of food in the entire world. I mean, that is correct, isn't it?
We certainly produce a heck of a lot more food than we could ever eat. Unfortunately, it's not equitably distributed.
Well, I'd like to talk about that, if you will, for just a minute. Let me remind the listeners that we're talking with Peter Rossett of Food First and Rachel Bronson of the Food Bank of Nevada County. How do we go about, I mean, what has to happen here for people not to have to worry about having to subsist, if you will, on, you know, the garbage of you know, grocery stores, or, you know, starving in the streets of our cities or around the world? Peter, let me ask you first, can you talk about that? I mean, what are the things that have to change?
Well, I think that the situation has gotten substantially worse since the late 1970s on. We've had a real change in the pattern of economic growth in America. We used to have a pattern of economic growth that was rooted in places, in cities, in regions, that as productivity increased, more jobs were generated, more money circulated in the local economy, and more people were lifted out of poverty. But since we've been spending two decades now moving towards the global economy and free trade agreements, we've had the jobs running out of the country, moving globally, putting everybody in the world in a global competition for who will work for less, who will work for below minimum wage, who will work without health insurance, who will work without environmental standards. And we've had a pulling down on a global scale, felt very strongly here, right here in America, of wages and living standards. So it's a cumulative impact of policies really that began in the late Carter administration, were intensified under Reagan and Bush, and have been carried forward full force by the Clinton administration, changing to a pattern of economic growth where we now can have an economic recovery, an apparently booming economy, and more people than ever who are homeless and have to eat in soup kitchens. It's a pattern of unequal growth that's a result of policies that we never voted for. I would say undemocratic policies that have led to this tragic situation.
Well, one of the things that we're going to be covering increasingly as it gets closer, and that also I will be going to, is the World Trade Organization ministerial meeting in Seattle.
Well, you're hit right on the button.
Oh, I know it.
If you want to find a culprit for worsening hunger and poverty on a global scale, that's a good one right there.
Talk a little bit more about why you say that.
Well, as I said before, it's the growth of free trade policies creating the global market that puts working people in the world in competition for each other. Many have called it the race to the bottom. You just think about, instead of thinking about the whole World Trade Organization, we can think of NAFTA, Mexico, the United States, and Canada, as a mini example of what happens when you move from a national economy to a larger economy by unifying several countries' economies. You create a larger economy that creates economies of scale where bigger companies who use mass production techniques to produce goods at a lower cost can outcompete smaller companies. As smaller companies are driven out of business, in Mexico 60 to 70% of small businesses have gone out of business since NAFTA, the jobs are lost in those companies. Those companies made goods in a labor-intensive way. They employed many more people per product produced than do the transnational mass production companies who replace them. So we translate that to a global scale. We create enormous economies of scale, favoring the largest global transnational conglomerates with the most mass production technology, replacing people with machines on a global scale, means that there are far less jobs produced in the world now per unit of production as a result of these policies. And we really have to say at a certain point, do we really want to keep going in this direction? And I think Seattle would be a good moment to ask that question.
This is Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. We're talking with Peter Rossett, Executive Director of Food First, and we're also joined by Rachel Bronson, who is the Director of the Food Bank of Nevada County. Rachel, talk a little bit more, if you will, about the local situation here and the people you're serving, and perhaps, you know, how your view of what's happening here, you know, coincides or contrasts with some of the more macro issues that Peter is talking about.
Well, the food bank, as I said, you know, goes out into the county and distributes food to the low-income people. What I've seen over the year that I've been here is kind of the same thing Peter says. We are seeing more families. We have about 40% children that we serve. There are the single people that are out of work, but there are quite a few families that are surviving barely, but they are not being able to get the amount of food that they need, and so we are serving those people. Our mission is basically to procure and distribute food to those in need. However, if we were to be put out of business because of no need, that would just be perfect for me.
Right.
I think that would be the excellent solution. And we do get, like I said, a lot of help from the community. We get donations, which are actually down a little bit this year, but we do get a lot of public support through cash donations to purchase food and then donations of actual food itself from the local community. But that really is, I mean, it's an interim way to solve this problem. It's not really solving it in the future. And the future problem to be solved is not with the food banks, it's with the change in our society.
Well, you bring up an interesting point that I'd like to go back to, and that is that you said donations are actually a little down this year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the second time that I've heard that recently where, as I understand it, I may be wrong, but with all of this talk about this booming economy, which I think probably most of us would be in agreement that it's booming for some, but not booming for the majority of people, that in actuality, charitable giving is actually declining at the same mm-hmm. time all across the board. And I'm hearing you say that you've experienced that at the food bank here locally. Peter, do you have any thoughts on the whole issue of whether or not charitable giving is actually going down, or do you have any information about that?
Well, my feeling is when you have an economic boom, it depends on how the benefits are distributed in terms of the impact on charitable giving. Research shows that poorer people give a much higher proportion of their income to charity than do richer people. So when you have a boom like the present one, which is concentrated in the hands of a few, you would naturally expect that not to be translated into as large an increase in charitable giving as if you had a broad-based economic boom in which everybody benefited. That's when we would see a larger percentage of the new income being generated ending up in the hands of charity.
Actually, you bring up another point as well of something that I recently read, a critique, if you will, of the giving of the so-called rich, in the fact that, according to the article I was reading, that you know there are people who have a lot of money who give a lot of money to charitable causes. Very often, though, those causes are charitable causes that kind of fit into their lifestyle.
Sure.
Give money to the symphony.
Bill Gates giving away millions and millions of dollars, but it's mainly to increase computer literacy, which of course will translate into more sales for Microsoft products. We don't hear Bill Gates giving massive amounts of money to end hunger in the United States. And for every Bill Gates who's publicized as a philanthropic billionaire, what we don't hear about are the tens of millions of poor people who tithe a very substantial proportion of their income. The Chronicle of Philanthropy did an interesting study on ethnic groups in our country and found that African Americans give the highest proportion of their income to charity of any ethnic group. Second are Latinos. Third are Asian Americans. And last are European Americans. So when you look at the whole population, it turns out that the real charitable giver is a relatively poor African American, not a Bill Gates, but a Bill Gates gets all the publicity.
Well, that's really interesting. That's the first time I've heard that kind of laid out that way, and certainly that would go counter, I think, to what a lot of people would think.
And think about it. If you're hungry, whether you're in a village in the third world or in a poor neighborhood in the United States, are you more likely to be given a glass of water and a sandwich knocking on the door of a very poor family or knocking on the gate of a wealthy gated compound millionaire's house?
Really?
And all of us knows that the poor are much more generous in those circumstances.
Well, I was going to say, I don't think that's all that difficult a question to answer. We're talking with Peter Rossett, who's the executive director of Food First, and also joined by Rachel Bronson, who is the director of the Food Bank of Nevada County. Just to kind of go back to kind of finish the thought that I had, and is that this whole thing of charitable giving by quote unquote the rich is that, you know, indeed, as Peter stated, you know, yes, there's this giving, but it will eventually come back in business. It's almost a business investment. And
a tax-free business.
A tax-free.
Yeah,
very good point. And my point was that the article I was reading and talking about giving by the wealthy was that they give to things that really sort of support their own lifestyle, the symphony, art museums, those kinds of things that, yes, they're big charitable contributors, but they are contributing to charities that really sort of help round out their lives as compared to helping to share some of their wealth with people who are, you know, not going to the symphony. I mean,
sure.
Does that make sense?
Sure, although we're almost getting a little bit off the point.
And we are.
I really don't think that support for the symphony is the problem. The problem is an economy that is not providing broad-based benefits to the majority of Americans, and that same economic model being exported globally and creating the increased disparity between rich and poor around the world.
I know that Food First did a report about the situation in Indonesia. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. People may have remembered a lot of news accounts about a food crisis in Indonesia, massive international food aid. We were very concerned about that. We participated in an international fact-finding mission and found an unfortunate thing that, even more unfortunately, Food First has been finding for years in our research, which is that when our government provides food aid to other countries who supposedly don't have enough to eat. It, in fact, is a way of serving our own interests more than the hungry in the recipient countries. What we've been donating to Indonesia is a lot of wheat. It's a rice-eating country trying to change the basis of the Indonesian diet, as we have done before in South Korea and other countries, to products that are, that cannot be grown there, to create a dependency on U.S. exports in the future. We discovered there isn't actually any food shortage at all in Indonesia. There's a dramatic increase in poverty as a result of the Asian financial crisis. There's plenty of food there. People can't afford it because they don't have jobs. Sounds familiar. That sounds like the U.S. What our government's response is to send them thousands and thousands of tons of wheat. They already have more food than people can buy. The wheat ends up saturating their market with wheat products, creating a taste for wheat when they can't even grow wheat there.
So they wind up, in essence, becoming a food importing country. And, of course, where are they going to import wheat from?
That's right. And our government brags that most major countries, major importers of U.S. agricultural products, got started on the food import chain through food aid, supposedly to feed the hungry. But in reality, it's yet another disguised form of corporate welfare for the U.S. agribusiness and food trading companies to penetrate foreign markets.
The other thing that I've heard a little bit about is this whole issue of this sort of what's being referred to as Terminator technology, and that in essence what's happening is indigenous crops in various areas of the world are basically being wiped away and then replaced with these genetically engineered seeds and so forth that don't reproduce. And what happens then, of course, is that you have this whole issue of these transnational corporations actually patenting, you know, this seed, and therefore they actually then claim to own the stuff of life. I mean, that's another issue in all of this,
well,
isn't it, Peter?
Well, it's all examples of what's happening as we have an increasingly corporate, an increasingly transnational corporation dominated international food system, and they're basically gaining control all the way from the seed to the final packaged product. And that does produce convenience foods for some kinds of consumers, and that perhaps is a benefit to society. But what it also does is it's greatly increasing the ranks of the have-nots, of those who are excluded from this global food system because they don't have the cost of admission. And this is really something that as a society, both national and globally, we have to address. Do we want a food system controlled by the few in the name of profit, or do we want a democratic food system where achieving the basic human right to food as laid out in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948 becomes a reality rather than just a statement on a piece of paper?
We're talking with Peter Rossett, Executive Director of Food First, and Rachel Bronson, Director of the Food Bank of Nevada County. Peter, what I want to do is ask you first this question, which is maybe the $64 billion question. It seems to me that government as it exists today seems to exist primarily, if not solely, to further the interests of the type of people who want to create the kind of food system that is being created. I mean, do we agree on that?
We do.
How do we stop them?
Campaign finance reform.
Okay.
And a step in the right direction. And trying to promote, as you do in your radio program, more public discussion of these issues so that we can have more democratic input in policymaking. To me, that's really the bottom line. We have a campaign at Food First called Economic Human Rights, The Time Is Now, focused on hunger in the U.S. I would urge people to come to our website and look into the campaign. That's www.foodfirst, all one word, foodfirst.org, O-R-G. I think that we need to become a political movement saying that this isn't the way we want things to be.
Let me also ask you, if you can, to give a phone number for those people who may not have access to the Internet.
Certainly. Area code 510-654-4400 or foodfirst.org.
We're also joined by Rachel Bronson, who is the director of the Food Bank of Nevada County. Rachel, I'd like to ask you, if you could give contact information for the food bank so people could, if they so chose, make an effort to be of help there.
Sure. We'd like to encourage anybody locally or that can hear us to give us a call at 530-272-3796 if they'd like to donate cash or food to help us with our mission. We do receive funds through United Way, so if you're a United Way supporter, you can designate the food bank, and that's one way we do get food or donations from the public. So anybody who would like to send anything out to us, our address is 12048 Charles Drive, number 9, and that's in Grass Valley, 95945.
Peter Rossett, the Executive Director of Food First, do you have any final thoughts for our audience today?
Well, I think that we need to have a serious discussion about the direction in which our country is going. We need to engage in a national debate, and I think that we ought to start, each one of us, thinking about these issues and discussing them with our friends and our neighbors. That would be a good starting point.
And can you give the number for Food First one more time, please?
Again, it's 510-654-4400. Our webpage is foodfirst.org. We are a membership organization, so listeners, we'd love to have you join us.
Peter Rossett, Executive Director of Food First, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Rachel Bronson, Director of the Food Bank, a final thought for our audience today?
I'd just like to thank all the support that we do have locally. I think there is a bigger problem, however, and I agree with Peter that we all need to deal with it.
And can you give the phone number of the food bank one more time?
It is 530-272-3796.
Thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's it for this edition of the program. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. If you're interested in copies of this or other Full Logic Reverse programs, you can contact us via email at flr@jps.net or by telephone at area code 530-265-9462. Full Logic Reverse is produced at FLR Studios in Nevada City, California, USA. Our music is by Rick Payne. We hope you'll join us next time for another edition of Full Logic Reverse.